Cảm ơn HBV Việt Nam đã đồng hành cùng Vietcetera cho lối sống từ chối rủi ro, sống lành chủ động.
Xin mừng mọi người đến với Have a Sip uống gì không? Thì mình gặp mọi người mỗi tuần vào tối thứ 6. Trong những cái cuộc phỏng vấn, những cái cuộc ghi hình của mình thì rất là nhiều lần thì mình cảm thấy biết ơn bởi vì mình có những cái cuộc trò chuyện và thì mình tin là những cuộc trò chuyện đó cũng rất là quan trọng với mọi người. Hôm nay nhân lúc đang được nói tiếng Việt thì mình phải nói trước là đây là một cái tập mà mình rất là run vì là có những người mà mình chỉ nhìn ở trong một cái thế giới xa xôi ở trên Internet. Hôm nay ở trước mặt thì mình... So I just say that I feel a little bit, you know, starstruck because I always see you just on the screen, on the Internet, and here you are. Welcome to Have a Sip, Crystal.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a long time that you got back to Vietnam. Why?
I think timing.
Mm-hmm.
Having children got in the way a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
My parents have come back many times, but they warned us, like, the kids are too small, it's too hot, it's too rough, and I think they're just trying to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
But right before the pandemic, we had planned this trip to come, and then, of course, the pandemic happened, and we had to make a decision, so we had to cancel all of our plans.
Mm. And how you feel... about Vietnam. Oh, you just landed last night.
I just came in last
night. Oh my God. So,
I have an impression.
Okay.
A lot of energy.
Mm.
And I know there's nothing here for me to remember because I left so young, but I feel, I don't know, oddly emotional.
And that thought came before or it just hit more when you get here?
I thought of it before,
uh-huh.
But it's different when you're here.
Yeah, yeah.
So we stood on the rooftop at our hotel and we looked out and I just kept looking around like I could be that person who was serving drinks or
uh-huh.
working on the car or whatever. That could have been my life.
Mm. So you are, for me, the most likable guru in the design world. Did you always know that you're going to end up like this? And if you have to point out the moment that it changed your life in this path, what moment is that?
Mm. I don't think so, not at all. I was happy to work behind the scenes and direct commercials and music videos and run my company. But a friend of mine, classmate from Art Center, he invited me to make YouTube videos.
Mm.
And I told him, sure, I'll film, you be in front. And he's an interesting guy, just a good friend. And he said, no, we don't do this without you. You have to be here with me. And I worry like what everybody worries about, which is, hey, I don't know if I should say something. If I say something that people don't like it or they like it too much, I just am too concerned about that. So he's such a good friend. He said to me, I know you're not comfortable. You just sit here. And when you feel comfortable, you could say something. So if you watch the very early episodes, I don't say anything. I just sit there. And he introduces me. I can't even introduce myself because the words won't come out. So it's been a long
uh-huh.
little journey here.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that when you in Vietnam, you would picture yourself as some, you know, the waiter that's working in
mm-hmm.
the car. Why not a designer?
I don't know. Because then my life would be very different. Because if I was a designer here making YouTube videos, then it would just be the Vietnamese version of me in Ho Chi Minh
mm-hmm.
City versus the Vietnamese version of me in America.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think about that, like how your circumstances and your environment can shape your thinking. And perhaps here, maybe people have a different way of looking at life, so it can hold back some of the decisions they make, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
But why not, like, this is Crystal that went to America, mm-hmm. and this is Crystal stayed in Vietnam. And maybe, at one point, you guys meet and you still become who you are this day. I know it's more of like, but it could be, right?
It could be. And I talked to my wife about that.
Uh-huh.
And I said that I think there's still the person who wants to do something will find their way regardless of where they're born. But we can only say it in theory until you know in real life. You just don't know.
Yeah, you just don't live two lives at the same time.
Yeah.
So the podcast will have a sip. So, of course, the sip is important. Share a little bit of behind the scene. It took Chris a while to choose a drink on the menu. Why is that? Is it always like that?
No, it's because I don't drink coffee.
Mm-hmm.
I usually don't have hot beverages when it's warm. And I try to avoid sugar whenever I can, and I don't drink alcohol, so I'm like looking through it, and the kombucha option looked interesting, but you warned me, hey, it could have a strong flavor, and I don't have an upset stomach when I'm talking to you. That would be bad.
Okay. So you end up with...
the Earl Grey Nitro.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So in the list section that you option that you have, you go for that.
Yeah.
What make you, you know, although that's why the tea on the table?
Well, because I like tea. It has caffeine and it's clean. Mm-hmm. There's no calories as far as I know.
And then do you always need the nitro part in it? Is that something?
I've never had nitro before. I don't even know what the nitro part is.
So do you, well, I ask quite ordinary detailed questions, because at the beginning of the podcast, I always try to figure out what the drink would tell
about the
guest. Do you in life have a lot of, like a small element of something you haven't tried?
I try lots of things, I think. Mm-hmm. But the circumstance of what we're doing right now would not be good if I had something that really made me feel out of character, and that way I can't be present for what we're doing. So if we're out somewhere on the street and there's no interview, then maybe I can try something a little bit more daring. But right now it's like functional, like what's gonna make my throat tighten up, right? And I need to be a professional and be present to this.
Okay. Yeah. So what's the most daring thing that you try?
In terms of a drink or anything?
In terms of anything.
I think the most daring thing for me to try was the beginning of my career.
The YouTube
To go against what my dad wanted and to pursue a career in design.
What your dad wants you to become?
Anything but design. Something more serious.
And did you try that?
No, I didn't, because I'm not a good listener.
So that's the thing, right? Some of us will end up doing some different things, but we will try what our parents want us to do for a bit to realize that, oh, this is not what I want.
Yeah.
What's going on at that time? Because I assume at that time you're not the crystal right now, which is know what you want. But in the young days, how you have a guts to not doing that?
Yeah. I do want to say something. I'm the middle child of three boys. So my older brother, he went to UC San Diego, and then he got accepted into Stanford to go to graduate school. So he got all the brains. So I'm the middle child. I didn't focus that much on school, and I was dreaming and drawing and playing, but it didn't have any serious application. My grades weren't horrible, but they're not good enough in America to like get into the good university. So my dad is pretty hands-free. He didn't tell me, like, you have to do this. He encouraged me to do certain things. He encouraged me to focus on school, which I didn't do. I just know that this art and design thing, it's a very uncertain future. And my dad loves me. And he cares about me. And he doesn't want me to have to suffer in life. He doesn't want me to be poor. But he's not telling me, you have to do this. He's just concerned that this may not work out. He's a very conservative man, and I understand that. But all my life, it's like, I'm not doing this to my dad on purpose, but as soon as he starts to figure out what I'm doing, I go do something else. And then he's like, oh, why don't you stay with that, right? I'll give you an example. So I do design, and then I'm thinking about dropping out, and my parents are like, just graduate, please, just graduate. Finish school first. And then I get this really good job in advertising, and I tell them how much money I'm making, and they're like, okay, just stay with that. And then I quit that job. And I'm going to start my own company. And they're like, oh, my God, what are you doing? And then it takes them over 10 years to understand what it is that I do for a living. And then I'm starting a YouTube channel. And they're like, oh, not again. So I think there's this expression that children are brought into the world to torture their parents. And maybe in this case, I'm torturing my parents.
But now we parent. We would not want that, right? Or you don't mind?
I don't mind. Mm. My two boys... I just tell them, you could be poor, you could be rich, you could be anonymous, you could be famous, you get to do whatever you want. I have this philosophy as a parent that I get to pursue what I want, and I'm not going to then put my dreams on you. You get to do whatever you want. So one son is studying philosophy and writing, and the other son is going to probably pursue a career in art and illustration. It's up to them. I remember one time my son walked through the office when he's much younger. And he's like, so this is going to be mine, Dad, one day, right? I'm like, no, it's not. It's no, that's not how this works. I don't want to create that. You get to live your dreams. You get to live your life.
Yeah, my son would ask, like, you have a lot of money, right? I'm like, what makes you think so, right? I'm like, it's like they see things, they assume things.
Yeah.
But were it hard for you when you were growing up? I guess when you share that you're the middle son, like it feel like the pressure's on someone else.
It is.
And then you can be a little bit more free. But yeah. was it hard, like, to be the person at that time? Like, I don't need to listen.
I don't think it was hard.
Okay.
Because both of my parents, they are very hands-off. First of all, they're really busy because they're trying to make a living, providing for us. In America, we're called latchkey kids. Are you familiar with that term?
No.
Basically, they send you to school and you have a key and you go home and you just stay inside until they come home from work. And that's how it worked.
There wasn't Danny or babysitter. Also, it's similar to in Vietnam.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. And so we had a lot of time to figure out who we are, what we're going to do. And my parents just worked. And so we have the weekends together. We have some vacations, but they didn't. And I think this is a blessing, really, because I think about how I'm able to make my own decisions and go my own ways because no one was really telling me, you have to do this. And even though my dad did not really approve of pursuing design, he didn't tell me, like, hey, don't do that. That's a terrible decision. I like to think that I'm pretty stubborn and I know what I want, but I didn't. I think I could overcome my dad saying, don't do this. But I wasn't tested, so I don't know. So I'm fortunate. And then later on, I find out that my mom told my dad, you're not allowed to say this to your son. You just let him do what he's going to do. So all this time, I'm just doing what I'm doing. And no one's saying anything. They're just concerned it's a lot of money to spend to go to school.
Were you a slow reader?
I am a slow reader.
Yeah, you are?
Yeah. I'm a slow reader, and I've learned that I learn much better visually. And when I listen to an audiobook, I can't retain nearly as much. I need to see the words. And I have a hard time spelling words until I see them. Because the way people pronounce them, I'm like, how do you spell that? I need to look at the word. But when I see the word, it locks in my mind much more concretely than hearing somebody say something. And so I found that when I'm reading, I'm processing the information a little bit differently than everybody else. Give you an example. If two people sit down and read a book and one finishes but doesn't recall what they read, then the point of them reading is lost. And I think a lot of people want to feel good about themselves, so they say, oh, I've read 10 books this month or 10 books this year or 100 books this year. And then I'll ask them, what did you read? Tell me about the ideas. And more importantly, what did you apply? So when I read, I try to read at such a pace that I can remember what I read so that I can teach it to other people. So I'm a slow reader.
But when you're talking about slow, like how slow?
I could read a book a day.
In a day?
Yeah.
That's not slow.
Well, I think compared to some other people.
Oh, depend on, you know, when you're talking a day, like it's like
8 hours
or 9 hours. Okay,
yeah. Nine hours, yeah.
What's the thing is, like spending, I think it's the effort of like, to spend its 9 hours to read a book is already something. Like normally it's like, okay, today I do how many pages and so... I don't know what's come first. Like you feel like you were a slow reader, then you decide to do visual, or like you always know that visual words like something.
Visuals is the way to go.
Okay.
I've known since I was as old like as I can remember that's what excited me. So when I talk to young people, especially, or people who are changing their career, midlife crisis, that if you think back to when you're like 5 or 7 years old, and you remember what gave you the most joy, what made your heart beat really fast and got you shaking in bed thinking about it because you get to do it the next day, I think that's what you were designed to do. And so many of us forget about that. We bury it and we ignore it and we suffer a lot because of that. And I don't know if you believe in God or creator or some universal design, but I think each one of us has some very unique things about us that we can do better than most people on earth. And a lot of the suffering comes from us not understanding what that is and then trying to fit ourselves into somebody else's definition of us. And so when I was young, I drew all the time. And I remember very clearly, like I think I was maybe 4 or 5 years old, sitting in my great uncle's lap as he was showing me how to draw. He's passed away since, but, and I just love that. I hold that memory. I remember when I was 7 years old for my birthday, people gave me gifts. All my uncles and aunts gave me gifts. But the one uncle who gave me a big pad of paper and some markers, that's the one I remember. I can't remember the other gifts. So I know that in my life, I was meant to make things visual.
Mm-hmm. So how long it took you from that moment, kind of, you know, got that feeling, to believe that, oh, you are the designer now and then this is your career?
I think it took about 18 years.
Okay.
So I finished high school, I go to college, and I now made the commitment to myself, I'm going to go ahead and study design.
Mm.
And then I start to see that I can do a better job than most of my classmates. I'm not trying that hard yet. So I start to think to myself, what if I really try? What if I really apply myself? And then the voices from my dad start playing in my mind, like, apply yourself and see what you can do. So then it made sense to me, like, this is what he meant. But before, I couldn't apply myself because those things bored me. Chemistry bored me, physics bored me, math bored me. But art and design and creativity did not bore me.
Mm.
And so I knew that that's what I needed to do.
But at the same time, you were like in the middle of something, you quit it. And you know, you didn't, what make at the moment, like, for example, you drop out of school?
No, I made it.
Oh,
I made it.
Okay.
Yeah, they told me not to, and so I was like, okay, let me finish.
Okay.
Yeah.
But what the moment, like, why you wanted to do it?
This is going to sound
terrible.
That's
what you like, right? It's like,
I love it.
Yeah.
This is going to sound terrible, but I'm going to tell you, okay? So I go to design school. It's a four-year program. And about 3 years into the four-year program, I start to realize I've now have learned more than some of my instructors. And so it seems strange now. So I had the benefit of doing my lower semester work with some brilliant teachers, and they unlocked the world of design for me. And so when I started to take classes with other instructors, I thought, wait, where'd you go to school? Like, how is it that you're talking about design this way? And I'm still a student here, so this doesn't add up for me. So I then became really disenfranchised with education. I thought to myself, there are a handful of really good instructors, and they fill in the rest of them with okay instructors, so that they can take your money.
Mm.
And so I started getting into a very dark, negative place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I thought, I'm done with school. I don't need school anymore.
In Vietnam, even heavily, they will put like a teacher label. Like, it's like you go into school and then the way you study is like they tell you things that's supposed to be true and right. And sometimes you have questions. I got a bad experience with, I would just walk out of the class. I got kicked out.
Yeah.
Because I was laughing at something ridiculous that the teacher said.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't dare to laugh, but my body just react and I got kicked out.
Okay.
But then for at the young age, we know that, but I think the important part is like there's a war between what we think and then how we break through that war. So I don't know what in there for you, what's there that make like, or I don't know, later in life, how you break that war, like knowing that what you think here is right and it can turn into reality.
Yeah. I think we have to be careful that what we think of ourselves doesn't run into delusion or arrogance or being unkind to people. And I think Vietnamese people, like Asian culture, We know how to respect. We know how to respect elders. And even if I disagree with you, I'm not going to be disrespectful. So that's a big thing for me. So even though I thought my instructors didn't know more, and they should know more, and I just became a little sad, I didn't openly disrespect them. I didn't say, this is dumb. You don't know what you're talking about. I would just do the work. But I wouldn't try so much. Because I knew they couldn't tell the difference.
Mm.
And maybe that's a dangerous place to go down. But I just stopped trying. And that's why I thought, maybe I need to drop out. This wasn't right for me.
Mm.
But there's something that I'm seeing that's also the opposite, which is especially in America, where they don't have the same cultural references that you and I might have. And so they openly challenge teachers. They question everything. And we think, isn't that what leads to all these innovative companies and innovative thinking and this rebel spirit? Maybe, but I'm not so sure. Because it makes teaching those kinds of people very, very difficult. And later on, one of my friends introduced me to a Japanese concept called shuhari.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting how you should learn. So I may be butchering this from a Japanese point of view, but the first part is when somebody is teaching you, there's a master and there's a student. The student should do everything they can to learn exactly as the master teaches. This is very important. Do not deviate. Do not try to change it. And I think shu means to protect or to not to alter Okay. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the point in which you've learned all the fundamentals from the master. And then the next thing is you need to learn other methods.
Mm-hmm.
So now you can leave this master and learn from other masters. And then the last part is you can then challenge and mix and combine and create your own thing. And if you look at martial arts, it makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like a core discipline, and then there's little branches that break off. And I think this is really important, because when I try to coach people and I try to help them, when they say, hey, can you help me build a business to make $1 million? I said, yes, I can. And then I tell them something, but I don't want to do that. Okay, well, how about this? Well, that's not going to work for me either. So you really don't want any real information from me. Well, I want to do it my way. I have to experience it. Then I say, okay, then clearly I'm not your teacher. So I think there's got to be a mix between these two worlds, like blindly, obediently following someone versus totally disrespecting everyone and saying, I know better than all my teachers. So I think the key to this is, in your life, you should have the ability to decide who you want your master to be. And the master will accept you under one condition. You must do everything I tell you without question.
Mm.
And if you enter into an agreement where both people agree to that, then I think it works really well. But when you're young, you go to school, you have no choice. And so you're forced to say, that's my master. I must do what he or she says. That can lead to a lot of like really negative feelings about the person, about yourself, and can create a lot of trouble. Mm. That's why for me, when I turned 18, it was like freedom. Because now I'm going to choose.
Mm. You sound like those, you know, kung fu cartoon or movies,
yeah.
Like, you know, like when they train martial arts. I'm
yeah.
thinking the Karate Kid, like that movie, like they have to go through a very hard process. Too.
Yes.
Yeah, too.
Yes. Almost all kung fu films mm-hmm. follow a very strict formula
mm-hmm.
and they work, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm a fan of Jackie Chan.
Okay.
Okay. Jackie Chan, the Hong Kong films, right?
Yeah.
So he's usually like a bum,
mm-hmm.
maybe an orphan. He has no discipline, right? So that sounds like everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody until they figure out their life.
Yeah.
Then he finds a master, and then the master treats him like a dog.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it goes. And he keeps trying to break the rules, and eventually he learns to love and respect the master. And then they do the training montage,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah,
and then Eagle Claw, Shadow Fist.
Yeah, yeah.
They do the exact same moves over and over.
Yeah.
And then one day, somebody kills the master. He tries to avenge him using the same technique as the master. It doesn't work. Mm. Because the master is already better at you than you.
Mm.
So what does he do? He gets drunk, learns drunken style, and then adapts that. So this is the Shuhari principle in action. And then he can avenge his master by defeating the villain in the story. So these stories, I think, are designed to tell us something.
Mm.
There's like lessons here that we never understand.
Well, in my kung fu film, the master doesn't need to die, but in your...
Well, this is how they're told, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. They should. I don't want to die. Let me just put that out there, okay?
If you go back to that time, would you drop out of school or you would just stay, try to be with that master?
I think finishing school was the right decision.
Okay.
It was just one more semester,
mm.
but I was just so impatient.
Mm.
I was so full of like myself, I think, at that time. And now I think, you know what? I have a different worldview today. I live in a place in my mind where I can be right. And you could be right, and both of us could be wrong at the same time.
Mm.
So we have individual truth, and then we have objective truth.
Mm.
And objective truth is so rare to come by. So the mistake that most people make is my individual subjective truth becomes my belief that that's objective truth.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that every day the world, it changes a little bit because we learn a little bit more about how things work. And that means all the old data that we held to be true are now untrue. So I want to live in a place where I hold my opinions, have strong opinions, but I hold them, what the expression is, weakly. That means if you have a better truth, I will just let go of this truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay.
So I did not finish school.
You didn't finish school?
I didn't even start. I spent 4 months and then I was so bored.
Yeah.
But, you know, what would you say about sometime for me, right? There's a time, I'm not sure right now, but there's a time I feel like when I was writing some essay, whatever, I don't want to finish it because finishing it, it's boring to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you picture your journey, like, okay, if you get to that point, it's going to be awesome. People are going to love you.
Yeah.
But it's also very predictable and boring.
Mm-hmm.
So then I usually just drop it there. It's just like you go to a party and you have so much fun. But then they say nowadays, like, you just need to live it, like, 30 minutes before it actually ends. Then you go home and feel good. Like, you don't need to be at the end of the party. And then maybe it's not that good as you think it is.
Yeah.
So what would you say about that? It's like, is that a thing that people should do? Or people should always need to finish what they start?
Mm. I think there are three different topics that you brought up.
I'm sorry, I'm all over the place.
I love it. The first one is like, should you finish school? I don't know if school's right for everybody.
Mm.
That if you look at some of the most successful people, they barely went to school at all. Bill Gates dropped out of Harvard. Mark Zuckerberg dropped out. Steve Jobs dropped out. Like, everybody drops out. I think there is knowledge, and knowledge isn't always acquired in a structure. And I think you may have tapped into some deeper wisdom or intelligence that isn't gained through a curriculum. Like, you experience life and you learn through life, and I think that's wonderful. So I think this singular uni path, like, we're just going to go down one path. Mm. I think we're starting to understand that it doesn't work for everybody.
Mm.
What brings you joy and the way that you learn the best is the right answer for you. So that's just part one. Part two, should you finish projects? I think you need to finish some projects, but you also have to be smart enough to say, this wasn't right for me. Right? But I think the problem is, and we have to kind of try to identify this, not about you specifically, about people who start projects who never finish them. I think many don't finish projects because really they're just protecting their emotional state, that if they finish, then that means people can critique it. That means the image of how great they are in their mind will be tested. So if you never publish a book, if you never post a video, if you never finish writing and release a song, the world will never know. And I think that's the way that you protect yourself. And I think if that's the reason why you're not releasing or finishing, that's probably not a great reason.
Mm.
And some people still say this, like, it's important for companies that people have a 4-year degree. It's not because the degree matters or the school matters. It's just say, like, I can complete something. I have enough discipline to start and finish something. Like, people who start repairing cars and never finish. People who build homes, but the roof is not on. It says something about that person, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think there was one more question. Like, do you remember at the end, like, what you were saying?
Yeah, like the party part.
Yeah, the party part. I think that's a totally different idea. I think what we have to do is realize that everything has a peak, and you're smart enough to see that it peaked and you're out.
Mm-hmm.
So when that can, you can talk about investments, you can talk about trends, you can talk about energy. So people who don't know will stay to the very end and then they'll be in the dip.
Mm-hmm.
But you're like, you know what? I feel like this is enough. I'm out. So you know when to get off the wave and move on to the next wave.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a skill.
Yeah. Thank you for breaking down my questions in three different parts. Do you always know that you could become a good teacher? Like, the way you structure things out and people throw at you, like, and then you're like...
I think I know two things about myself. One is I'm going to do something in the field of art and design, and that I'm going to teach. But I always thought, so here's the thing. This is about models and representation.
Mm.
So when you're a young person, like you said, your daughter said, Mom, you own this place. And so she sees a successful business person, an entrepreneur. So in her mind, a woman can run a business and a woman can be successful. A woman can do things on her own terms. But if you don't have that model, then you might not allow yourself to dream those dreams. So when I was a kid growing up in California, I don't have many models of professional creative people. The only ones I can see are the ones that are barely making enough money in life. And that's not what I want for myself. And then the teachers I look at, I'm like, you're going to live a life of suffering as a teacher. Teachers don't make any money.
Mm-hmm.
And they're openly disrespected by all the students, many of them. That's not what I want. So what we do is we take those two ideas. I'm a teacher. I'm a designer. I'm going to just bury those things.
Mm-hmm.
And you just bury it. And sometimes those seeds, they grow. And there's nothing you can do. And then you then say, okay, I'm going to surrender to what it is I'm supposed to do. And I learned design. And even in design school, I was already helping out my classmates. They would come to me, like, my same classmates would say, hey, can you help me with my homework? I'm like, we're in the same class. Why are you asking me? But sure, I'm happy to help you. So before I graduated, I saw a lot of students who just graduated and would return to teach because they need more teachers. I thought to myself, this is not a good model because you haven't experienced anything. You're not like Jackie Chan. You didn't find the drunken style. You're just regurgitating what you learned, but you're not as good as the master. So now the students that study under you are going to be poorer copies of you, and you're a poorer copy of your master. So I told myself, no matter what, do not teach until you know enough. And I put an artificial time limit on myself, 5 years, no matter what. And almost to the day, 5 years later, an opportunity came up, and then I said yes, because I felt like I had done enough at that point to start teaching.
Talking about the teaching phase, there's a designer in Vietnam, right? When I throw your name, they were like, oh my God, in our world, like Crystal, like teach something that you cannot find. It's online and it's free at that time, right? It was like, they were overwhelmed. How people react to when you've done that 5 years of not teaching kind of professional, and then you start. Is that exact 5 years or?
It's a 5 years, yeah.
Okay.
I graduated in 1995, and then I think I've started teaching at Art Center in 2000. Mm-hmm. And I want to clarify something. I've been teaching all my life. I just didn't have the title of teacher. Mm-hmm. When you run a company, you're teaching your staff. You're teaching them creatively what to do to solve a problem so that it could pass as your work, right? So when a client hires us as a company, they're not hiring Johnny or Mary to do the work. They're hiring Chris to do the work. But I'm not doing the work, so I have to teach them how to do it the way I want it done so that the clients feel like, yeah, this is great. Mm-hmm. This is what we paid for. So I've been teaching a lot, just not in the academic sense. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So that's what happens there.
I guess everyone teaching somebody's and everyone's learning from somebody.
Yeah, that's true.
Do it feel different, like become a teacher?
Yeah.
Academically and is it?
It is very different. Well, you think about it, like there are people that are working here, working for you. And so you say, okay, I want the edit to work this way and make sure the lighting. So they're doing it. So they're presumably paid and they're learning from you. And so that's the expectation of the relationship. Mm-hmm. But when you step into a room where they're paying someone else to learn from you, it's a strange relationship now. Now, I'm not paying you. You're paying me indirectly. And I'm supposed to teach you something. And the whole point of this relationship is how much transformation do I create for each individual that brings them closer to their goal? That's a big burden. Mm-hmm. So I know that the first year, it was a mess. I think I'm a good teacher, but I'm terrible. Objectively speaking, looking back, I was like, this is bad. And I'm suffering through it. And one of my biggest challenges was I'm teaching something that no one has taught me. Mm-hmm. Because after I graduate school, I'm in a new field that doesn't exist yet. So I'm learning and I'm figuring it out myself. And you know this, when you do something, it feels really easy. I don't know why anybody can't figure this out. I just figured it out myself. Just look at this. You just look at it and you could do that, right? That makes a terrible teacher. And I'll tell you something. The way I learned how to do direct commercials and make motion graphics was I was sitting in a conference room waiting to talk to Kyle Cooper. He's the guy who hired me to do a job. And he's so busy, so I'm just waiting here for like an hour. And so what I saw was along the wall, a bunch of storyboards, stacks and stacks of storyboards of different projects they were working on. So I'm like, nobody's here. I don't know what to do. I literally just walked and just looked at all the storyboards. And just seeing enough of them back to back to back, I figured it out. It just took that much time. That was it. Mm. So I figured out the game, what you're supposed to do, maybe in an hour. So now I get to work with students for 14 weeks for 5 hours a week. And I'm thinking to myself, why can't you guys figure it out? Why can't you see what I see? So that's the challenge, is to break down what it is that you saw that no one taught you, to explain it to another person. It's a really big challenge. Mm. So I do this now for like 10 years before I make my first YouTube video. So when people see me on YouTube, they're like, oh, how do you learn how to do this? Well, I put in 10 years. They don't know that. They just see, like, here's a video, and a guy just starts talking. But you put in the practice, and you start to learn what works and what doesn't work.
Mm. How's the feeling of figure things out when nobody else figured it out yet? Does it feel lonely sometimes?
I never looked at it as being lonely. Mm-hmm. It can be frustrating. Mm-hmm. But the reward is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. When you figure it out, there's a great sense of like accomplishment, like I figured it out. Mm-hmm. And you feel like you can do anything.
But then when it's, I guess when it gets the moment when you figure it out, but then the moment it's still inside here, how you know that what you figure out is a right, it's true, it's that in Vietnam, right? When I throw an idea, nobody take it. And then, at the young age, you doubt yourself a lot. But of course, it's come with experience that you're like, oh, if nobody, if they don't know the idea, it's good.
Yeah.
But that's a long way to form like what's in here, what you believe, until what people believe.
Yeah.
So I don't know, in the journey, what, they call the North Star, whatever, to keep right. you going on to that.
Well, there is something that real has happened to me, and happens to me all the time, actually, is I saw this emerging social platform like YouTube, Instagram, and all these other social platforms as a wonderful opportunity to publish content for free. It's like never in the history of humankind do you get to publish things for free, and we all have relatively equal access to it. It's an incredible time, right? Imagine if some printer here said, we will print whatever you want, newspaper, brochures, magazines, books, and we'll do it all for free. And all you have to do is find someone to pick them up. Mm-hmm. That's it. That would be an incredible thing. So I see this, and I'm still teaching at Art Center, and I'm having conversations with them. And one of my former instructors, her name is Linda Wyman, and Linda sold her company for $1.7 billion. And she just sold it. And she did education via online platform. And I was waiting in this really big room. I think there are like 20 or 30 professors. Some of them taught me in this room, so I have a lot of respect for them. After they talk about whatever their agenda is, I just raised my hand and said, I'm just concerned as alumni in that our institution may or may not be as relevant as we think it's going to be in the next 10, 20, 30 years. I have professional pride in wanting to see the school do well. Should we not address the online platform and the distribution of teaching through these platforms? And a lot of people looked at me like, who's this guy bringing in these weird, challenging ideas? And so I don't think they took it that seriously. But the department chair had a meeting with me, and he got together some people, and we met at my office, and I said, here's what we're doing. We're just starting in YouTube. We're already seeing things work. I'd love to help you bring the school into the 21st century. They listened for a little bit, and I'll tell you, I won't say who it was, but there was one person who just laughed. Not just like not say this isn't going to work, but laugh. And that person said, you're being an alarmist. They said the same thing about desktop publishing was going to replace designers. And I'm not for this at all. I'm like, okay. So you have an idea. You try to share with an open heart, so they shoot you down. At the same time, I was working as a board member for the AIGA, which is a professional design association. And I say the same thing. I say, we create content, we host talks, and we do events and studio tours, but we don't ever have anything to show for it. So the experience is, if you're not there live, it's gone. It's gone forever. Mm. I can help do this. I will spend my own money to help. And so we produce videos, and they didn't know what to do with it. So I said to myself after that, I've tried twice now to two organizations I love and respect, and I want to see them benefit from it. The only way that I can prove that my idea works is to actually do it myself. Because otherwise, I'm like every other kid out there who's like, you should do this, you should try that. I'm like, well, why don't you do it and see if it works? It's easy to give advice. So I start working on this thing, and it starts to work, and it starts to grow, and it keeps growing, such that the organizations that initially turned me down are like, wow, how do we get what you have now? So a lot of times you have ideas, and if you believe in them, it's almost like you owe it to yourself to see it through. Otherwise, I think you prove them right, that your idea was bad.
Mm-hmm. Right. To jump in and do it.
Yeah, you have to.
Do the hard work.
Yeah.
Has anything surprised you on that journey? Like starting the future, it's like anything you like, wow, I wish I knew it before.
A lot of things surprised me. Mm. One is that I can actually have a conversation with somebody on camera without throwing up. because it's I'm a pretty shy, socially awkward person who doesn't like going out at all. My idea of a good time, not to go to the nightclub and stay there to 2 a.m, is to go home, watch a TV show, read a book, and do some drawings. That's my idea of a good mm-hmm. time. So I shocked myself that I could do this and that I would actually enjoy it. And the cool thing is, when you pursue something and you pursue it in the spirit of like adventure, you never know where it's going to lead. Mm. And that's the beautiful thing. And I like that part, that I don't know what the next opportunity is going to be. I don't know where this ends, but I'm just going to keep pursuing it, because the interesting things is just more roads open up. Mm. And it's very exciting for me. So in 2014, we record our first YouTube video. It's been now 9 years. Mm. And now I'm asked to speak internationally. Mm. I get to meet you and talk to you. And we have lots of fans all over the world. Mm. And it's kind of like a weird, strange, beautiful novelty. As I was walking down here, I didn't know where this cafe was. And some guy's like, "Hey, are you Chris?" And I'm like, I'm a big fan. What are you doing here?" I'm like, "I'm here to record a podcast." Mm. And so the relationships that you get to build, the opportunities with partners, it's incredible.
Mm. No, when I watch your talk, right, it's like, you know, I watch a lot of talk. And then I'm a speaker myself, and yeah. I'm like, oh my God, I laugh so hard, and it's so charming, it's so lovable. Do you know that? Like, do you know that, right? Like, now you know it.
You know what? My wife keeps me very grounded. Okay. She's like, "You idiot, why'd you do that?" No, I love you, honey. So, you know, your family keeps you really grounded. Yeah.
No, but I love that you start all that, and you don't just go at home and just be introvert and then enjoying. But this, I mean, last year I interviewed one of like kind of biggest content creator on earth, the Nas Daily.
Oh yeah, Nas Daily. Sure.
Yeah. So they all about community, right? So they like, here's the thing: we don't know the future. Even your work is about the future, but then somebody big tell you that, oh, it, you know, the future is building community, that you kind of believe in it and find a way. But it's still such a myth for me. But I guess in your kind of work, it's a lot about that online community it you're is. Doing.
Yeah.
What's the secret of it? Like how to build a community?
It's not hard at all. Mm. You show people you care about them. And we talk about this, right? So I went to a private art school, and they have to pull your teeth to get alumni to donate. Why is that? And we kind of think about this. And they have all these campaigns, the giving campaign, holiday campaign, so that alumni will donate. And other schools don't have the same problem. The graduates from Harvard, USC, they give a lot of money. Mm. Well, there's a reason why. Because the graduates who finished those schools wind up becoming millionaires and billionaires themselves, and they attribute their success to the experience in school with their professors, what they learned, support services. And they felt a fair exchange in money for education. A lot of the universities have large endowments, so the tuition isn't crippling. Private art schools don't have the same endowments or the same size, and so it can cost $24,000, maybe more, I don't know what the tuition rate is, a semester. So if I'm a young person and I have a dream of being a designer, I think $24,000, so I'm going to be out $250,000 in debt. How long will it take me in my lifetime to pay that off? So then now that dream dies, or if I go through it and I suffer and I don't get the quality of the education that I was promised, so the amount of money I'm paying and the value that I'm receiving is not in alignment at all. So when I graduate, I'm just saying hypothetically, I become really bitter. I become angry that you didn't hold up your end of the bargain, yet I have the bill to pay. And you will pay that for the rest of your life with a job that doesn't exist for money that will never be there. That's a really bad situation. And so if you want to create community, what you have to do is you have to give with an open and generous spirit to try to help people. And if you do that, they develop an emotional connection to you. And this is really important. So a story I love to share with you is I went to one of the grad shows at Art Center. And there's this woman who walks up to me. She's like that tall. And she's like, "Chris, oh my God, I can't believe you're here." I'm like, "Why? Are you mad at me?" Maybe I'm not Chris. She goes, no, you've done so much for me. I'm like, is that okay? And she said to me, you've done more for me than this school. And I don't know who's there. It's just random people coming in because there's professionals, there's students, there's teachers. I don't know who she is. And then she messaged me later on Instagram, but I didn't know it was her. And she said, hey, do you have a Venmo account? I'm like, yeah. I give her my Venmo account. And the next morning, I go through my emails like I always do. And I'm like, wait, somebody gave me $1,000? Who is this person? And then I make the connection. It's the same woman from the grad show that sent me the Instagram. And here's the beautiful thing. Like, I don't take it for granted. Someone who gives you $1,000 and you didn't ask for, who asked for nothing in return, feels something. Something emotional, I believe. And the note that she wrote to me was, this is the first of many. I apologize. This is smaller. The next ones will be bigger. I was like, wow, this is incredible. So if you do something so good, you won't really have to ask. Mm. They will just give.
Mm.
And that's what happens. So when Naz is talking about what he's talking about, I'm sure he's feeling the energy that comes back. So what we try to do is we try to create as much good as we can to transmit it to the world. And the world receives it in whichever way they want. And it hits each person differently. Same video goes out, one person's like angry at us, like, how dare you, you're so arrogant, this and that. Somebody else is like, this is a game changer. Thank you for giving me the education I never got. And so they become grateful. And so you can build a pretty good community that way. I was going to say army, but community that want to see you win, that will support you financially, emotionally, spiritually. They will be there for you.
Mm. What do you see the future of the future?
The future of the future is we're going to change the game of education.
Mm.
I think in America, especially where good education costs a lot of money, that we need to change that whole system. There's an analogy. It's not my analogy. It's a beautiful thing. Every year, Apple comes out maybe twice a year with a new phone, and we feel like we just have to have it. So we're on version 15, I believe, right? I've been there since version 1. And they said, what has not changed at all throughout its invention? The education system hasn't changed at all. It's pretty much the same since it was invented.
Mm.
And why is that? It's surely like our society, our community, our understanding of the world has changed a lot. But outside of like a few fringe schools on the edges, it's taught in the exact same way that they were taught. So the institutions just keep moving forward. And so I think I want to change all that, but I have to prove the model. And my hope is we will change that model. And the model will be you're going to have access to really high quality education from the best teachers that exists in a model that's equitable for the student and for the teacher. Currently, something doesn't exist like that, right?
Mm.
So most teachers, when they teach, if they stop teaching, they stop making money until you hit retirement. But with our model, when you teach, you develop intellectual property. And so we pay you a royalty every time somebody buys it, forever.
Mm.
And so we think as the teachers get older, they're going to be able to gift their children or their grandchildren this legacy that their parent or grandfather, grandmother did something to help the world, and they get to collect the residual for that. Now, the number one might not be big, but they'll still collect something.
Mm-hmm. Well, not in Vietnam. It's funny. But during COVID, it's a little bit of, you know, tests a lot of different online model. But I talked to Aaron, one of the co-founder of the masterclass, and now Outlier.org. The way Outlier work was like, at the end, you still continue at the real school collecting credit. Is this going to be, or actually masterclass about, you know, learning singing with Christy Aguilera? Like, it's not academic.
Yeah.
I feel like it's no full on education academically yet. I don't know, art, is that something, the area that could work? But, you know, mathematics, is that going to work in the online world? Or
I believe so.
Mm-hmm.
I believe if we spend the kind of energy that is spent making a movie that bombs at the box office, that they lose so much money, if you spend a fraction of that, I think you can reinvent so many different things. Whenever I go and read the review of some movie that's terrible, they spent $300 million on it. They spent $200 million marketing it. So they're out $500 million and it doesn't make any real money. who are the idiots, the executives who signed off on this? Mm. But their model exists in such that they can have a couple of hits and lots of losers. And that's how their model works. It's a hit business, right? Same thing with the record industry. The hit artists, the global superstars, pay for all the indie artists who never really go anywhere, that they invest a lot of money into. Or at least that's what we're told. If we say we want to teach mathematics for sixth graders and we want to cover trigonometry or something like that, let's do a research or a casting call for the best teachers teaching it the most dynamic way. It could be somebody from India, it could be somebody from Vietnam or Mexico. We don't know. And we want to cast the best teacher. And the best teacher could have done it for 1 year or 100 years. We don't care. Just we love the way you teach, the way your mind works, the way you excite people, the way you hold people's attention, and the way you explain complex concepts really simply. That's what we want. And so we build a workshop around that. And we use 21st century tools. We use everything that Masterclass uses, script writers, producers, story editors, all those kinds of people to help you make the very best educational product that can be made. And we can do that at scale. What you can't do is you can't scale a small classroom because the number of students to teacher ratio impact the quality of education and attention. But that is private school. But for everything else, we can do at scale. My one complaint critique about Masterclass, is that they've hired a lot of celebrities who've never taught. In fact, that's one of their slogans. Like Frank Gehry says, I've never taught a class before. And that's supposed to be a marketing strategy. And I think that's a terrible thing because I know it took me at least 10 years to become a decent teacher. Going in like every day, putting in the reps, working with people, getting coached and training. So how is someone who's never taught before going to teach a class? That's the problem, right? Christina can sing. Usher can sing and dance. But can they teach? That's the real question. I'm not saying that they're not good teachers. I'm just saying that's a big question to think about.
Now you brought it up. In Vietnam, there's this saying, who cannot make it, go teaching.
Yes.
What do you think of that?
I think that's insulting.
Okay.
I think it's really insulting. Because we now say, well, who'd you learn from? All of us learn from teachers. So you're saying all of the teachers you've had since you were old enough to go to school till now could not make it in the real world. I think it's an insult.
Okay, sorry to put it out.
No, in America they say the same thing. Those who can't do, teach.
So it's good that you there's something to look forward to in the future. I'm sure as parents we see our kids entering the world. Well, your kids is like a little bit bigger. Maybe they entering a kind of serious education now, right? 20 and 17, right?
Yeah, one son is a sophomore in college.
Okay, so my kid is like 12 and 7 and they... Right now, they just learned how to write and read, but you know, soon they. I'm excited to know what kind of, you know, I love shortcut. I love something like you don't have to go into like a normal routine. Maybe that's how I did it. So I'm curious about if there's a future of the education. I would love to see them experience it. But go back because your father passing by.
Yeah, ignore him.
No, I love it. I love that.
He's hovering.
You know, that's the whole idea of the set. Like I see people walking by as it's moving. How's the relationship after now? I'm sure you're successful, and do they change the way they look at you? Because some parents they never change.
I think some changes happen, but I don't think it's a seismic change. I think my mom and dad both love me. They support me. They don't want to see me suffer. That part has not changed. I think their understanding of what I do has evolved and changes, and I think that's a good thing. But I don't think they love me any more or less because I'm successful or not successful. I think they're totally okay with that. They just don't want to worry about their children.
Right? They understand what you're doing now?
I think so.
Okay. Oh, that's
I leave a lot of clues.
Okay.
So my mom will watch a video and said, oh, I like what you said in this video. I'm not sure if my dad watches, but that's okay. Yeah. Like, I'm not living for them. I don't expect them to live for me. Okay. I live for myself.
Okay. Yeah. I guess it's how smooth the relationship, because I talked with that some Vietnamese overseas, that the struggle is bigger. To carry the pressures from the family side, because you know the culture adaptations and everything, it's very hard. I don't know from what I see from you, it seems smooth.
Well, it is smooth for us. Mm. It's a shame. I think it's a tragedy. And if I could just bring parents together and say, hey, parents, these are your children. They have their own lives. And what you don't want to do is raise your children to make up for the mistakes that you've made in your life. And that's really what parents do. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't go to that university. You should. I didn't make it all the way to grad school, and you should. It's like, based on what? Mm-hmm. And so I think what happens is we have to like not be so possessive of our own children. Like, we should try to master our own thoughts and feelings and work on ourselves. But it's much easier, like I said before, for you to tell other people what to do than for you to do it. Like, you should exercise more. You should eat right. But look at me. It's like, I'm not eating right. I'm not exercising. Because it's just easier for me to tell other people to do that. So in a way, we live vicariously through our children as if they're some programmable thing. And what we do is we just mess them up. Mm. And I think that's a tragedy. Yeah. So I have people who message me on the internet and saying, Chris, my mom and dad won't let me pursue this career. So I just say two things to them. One, what is your parents' opinion about you matter to you, and why? Why is that so important for you? Stop blaming your parents. If you want to do something, and you've done many things without asking them permission before, right? Yeah. But what happens is you want to do something, you say, and then you use them as an excuse for why you haven't done it. That's blaming them for something. As long as you're, in America, 18, you get to do whatever you want. It's your life now. So stop blaming others for the life you don't have. Have the courage and the conviction to pursue it, knowing very well their consequences. You could suffer, or you could be successful. Mm-hmm. That is entirely up to you at this point.
Do you think much about being in the Vietnamese-American community? I was like surprised. The first video I saw you, I don't know the power of YouTube, the TED Talk. There's a TED Talk. I could not find it anymore.
No, it's not. I haven't done a TED Talk.
Oh, so there's some talk that I thought is the TED Talk.
Yeah.
I was surprised that I found out about you and you Vietnamese American.
Yeah.
Is that something that's a big part in you, or you don't think much as of Vietnamese?
That's a good question. You know, I asked my mom this question when I was younger. I said, Mom, do you dream in Vietnamese or do you dream in English? And she said, I dream in Vietnamese, son. Why? Because I walked away thinking, Mom, I don't dream in Vietnamese. I dream in English. And what am I? Our culture, identity, our family, it's just torn apart. And now we start over in a country that's not ours, where no one looks like us, sounds like us. And there's a lot of cultural divide. There's racism, there's prejudice, there are stereotypes. And for a long time, I've had to battle this thing because I'm a small guy. I'm not a big person. To get bullied and to be teased for nothing except for just to exist, it was a hard way to grow up. I didn't have a lot of friends, and we moved around a lot too. I think I have some kind of identity crisis because I just want to be left alone. And people have asked me this before. And they were saying, like, if you had a superpower, what would it be? And like, people say, I want to fly, I want to have heat vision, I want to be super strong. I said, my power would be to turn invisible, because that's all I wanted to be. I just wanted to be invisible. So I've had a lot of inner conflict with who I identify as. And I just thought, if I was an American in my mind enough, people would just leave me alone. It's taken a long time for me to come back and say, I'm a Vietnamese person who happens to be in America, and I have to learn to embrace my culture, my heritage, and to reclaim my own power. And it's been a difficult challenge. The moment came to clarity for me during graduation at Art Center. It's an international student body. People from Japan, Korea, China, Taiwan, all kinds of people there. Not many Vietnamese people. And when they graduated, I saw them wearing their traditional clothing, to be so proud of their culture. Mm-hmm. And I could not imagine myself seeing this, because they all came from a country where everybody looked like them and talked like them, that people like them ran the country. And they were here in America because their parents had enough money and affluence to send them abroad to study. So they're already doing really well in life. And so they're here proud to show like their Korean dress or their Japanese clothing. And I'm sitting here thinking, I could never think to myself I would wear an aoyai. How could I do that? Because I'm embarrassed, and like, this is something I've been trying to hide. And that moment started to change me. And I said, I see Asian people representing themselves, proud of their culture, and here I was still carrying some of the shame, the fear of like not being accepted for who I am. So I'm 22 years old at that point in my life to start to come to, how do I reconcile this? Mm. So it's been a difficult journey.
Mm-hmm. And then move forward to the next generations of our children. My daughter, not only dreaming in English, but like chose, like my identity is English.
Yeah.
And then I cannot do anything. I tried very best of myself to speak Vietnamese to her, still now. But yeah, she chose, she answers, and she's like, Mom, you Vietnamese, right? And I'm like, I don't know, in the future, there's no such a Vietnamese American. It's just them, like a mixture of everything, and then finding their own identity.
Yeah.
So I don't know, is your kids like, it's like form your generations, and then to them, like, how is that different? Or you still see the Vietnamese part in them?
I think this one's difficult. My wife is from Taiwan, and my kids have a lot of influence from my parents. They grew up very differently. They grew up in one house in an upper class community, going to private school all their lives. And in those private schools, they don't have a lot of tolerance for you picking on people. And so I think they grow up with a different identity of themselves, not having to hide. They just get to be whoever they want to be. And I find it really interesting that they identify as Asian living in America. Mm. And I think there's something beautiful, and they get to decide. I'm not here to say you got to be this or that. Mm. And I think the best way to drive your children away from you to do exactly the opposite of what you want is to tell them what it is that you want. You say, like, yeah. If I say you must go to school,
just like your father did,
they're gonna drop out. They're just gonna drop out, right? And so sometimes I have to provide some strong guidance. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's like you get to do whatever you want. You want to do homework, do your homework. If you don't want to do homework, don't do homework. You want to miss school, I don't really care. But you do need to know every decision you make has a consequence.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I just try to lead by example and show them how I'm living my life. And I think what's going to be really interesting for everyone in the next 10, 20 years is the gatekeepers who existed before to allow you or me to have a talk show, they're gone. They're the editors of magazines. They're the producers of TV shows, of news networks who get to write the stories. And so, of course, they pick the stories, not in a malicious way. They pick stories because they're convenient. They understand these people and these cultures. And so they just mirror their own culture. And so they dominate popular culture and media. So when you're growing up in America and you're a shy Vietnamese boy and you're trying to see in media, where are my people? You don't see it. So you don't dream that you can be in front of the camera because you just don't see it. So for me, it helped me to not have an identity because I just saw myself as successful. If there's a successful person, my identity is successful, therefore I can do it. It doesn't matter if it's black, white, Asian, Latino, or something else. They can do it. I know I can do it. But what's happening today is that you're on YouTube, you're on podcasts, you're part of media, and you don't need anyone's permission anymore. So it's really exciting for me. And I get to see this in real time because oftentimes I'm one of the only person of color or Asian speaking on a stage. And I hope this doesn't come across as being too full of myself, is oftentimes I get to have the last speaking slot. I'm the closing keynote. So to me, that's very affirming to say that of all the European, white, older men that you could have had closer show, you have me. And I take that with a great deal of responsibility. And just to say, like, you know what? And I look out into the audience, and I think this, I don't always say it. If this from Vietnam, who came to America, who lost his identity and found it again, can be up here doing this, I know you can. And I try to think and project that energy to them. And I think without it being like a big identity politics war, that I can project that energy and see if it hits anybody.
Mm. I think it's very encouraging, just not to Vietnamese, but for young generations. But there's anything that you teach people, but then you cannot apply it to your life. I think people ask you a lot of like, is that teaching people make your life easier? Like most people think that, you know, you come up with, you know, whatever you post, I read a lot of your posts, it's really helpful, right? I don't know if like it's helpful back to you.
It is helpful back to me because I feel that there's a time that you need to prove yourself, to make money, to win awards and have press or media, whatever it is, to be famous. And when you achieve that, then what else is there to do? And the only thing I can think of is to try to help other people. And so if I write something and somebody will send me a message later and they'll say something really beautiful and heartwarming, and sometimes the messages can be kind of dark, as you can imagine, it's the internet. Someone will say, I thought about giving up on life, on this career, on my family, or whatever it is they send me, and it breaks my heart to read it, but they like, you got me through a dark point in my life, and that's a big responsibility, and I take it on.
What are you going to do more in Vietnam this trip? Like, do you have an expectation before you get here?
I don't have any expectations. So many people keep asking me that. Like, Chris, what are your expectations? Like, I think the greatest way to disappoint yourself is to have expectations.
Yeah, I know.
You know, the only thing I can think of is be present to the moment. Open yourself to whatever happens, good, bad, or otherwise, right? I don't want to get in there thinking this is going to be like a culinary adventure of a lifetime, or this is going to be a reconnection with roots and unlock all these emotions and feelings that have been buried away. I don't know. I just go with it.
When I meant expectation, it's like you expect to have a good pho.
I don't even have that expectation.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't. Whatever food somebody puts in front of me, I'll eat it. And it's like, okay, that was wild. Or that was below average. I don't know.
Since when you're like this?
Since when I was like what?
Like no expectation. Because I know you're talking about meditations. Like,
yeah.
I think it's very important. And for me, I'm 40 years old this year. I just, you know, I do a lot of talk show with some like good friend with some monk. Mm. And I love the energy and everything, but not everything they say that I can adapt to my life until recently. Like, I'm like, there's a beauty in it. And I'm like, oh, finally, I got this. So I know the no expectation part. I'm just like, how soon you find it in life? Like,
pretty early.
Mm.
Yeah. I talked to my wife about this, who's finding a lot of comfort in some new age mysticism, religion and philosophy. And she'll ask me lots of weird questions. And I was like, you know, when I was younger, when I had a negative emotion, I really thought about, like, how is this helping me right now? Feelings of jealousy or regret? I thought they're kind of useless emotions. They don't produce a positive result. And she's recently read this book that she's just raving about all the time. It's a book called My Conversation with God. And she goes, hey, the book says this. There's only two real emotions in life. I'm like, what are they? Love and fear. Love and fear. You can reduce everything down to that. So if you're angry at somebody, you're afraid of something else. And so that's how you channel that energy. Your fear manifests itself as violence or something else. But I keep thinking about this. If a thought or an emotion doesn't make you stronger, doesn't make you believe more in yourself or to make you more generous or kind, is it really going to help you? But so many people, I'm sure you know enough of those people, that they just love to be so negative all the time. And I say, okay, well, the day that you decide you don't want to be that person anymore, you won't. And I just decided I don't want to be that person.
But if there's love and fear,
yeah,
what's your fear and what's your love?
There's so much to love about life. The first love should be that you're alive. You have people that you can spend time with. Everything else seems like a pretty, like, a luxury to me. What are we afraid of? I think we're afraid of unknown things, but I find great pleasure in the unknown. It's a chance to discover things. And if you look at it like from the point of view of an explorer or adventurer, then this whole life is a game. We get to find things we don't like. We get to find things we're not good at. But on the opposite of that, we get to find things that we do like and things that we're really good at.
Mm-hmm. Is there any moments that you, when you're not you and not this, you know, like I'm, like, how is it like?
When I'm not me?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure there are.
Yeah.
We all have those moments, right? I've also learned to be aware of when I'm being suboptimal or being a variant to myself, which I don't like. Then I'd quickly ask myself, what's going on here? Check in with yourself. Mm-hmm. And let's bring it back to where we should be. Mm-hmm. And when we're around strangers doing strange things, I think we start to act a little weird. If we feel unsafe, physically, emotionally, spiritually, I think we're going to start to act strange. And so we try to just recenter. Mm-hmm. I think your ability to acknowledge what's happening inside of you, being fully present to yourself, is a great start, because you're like, oh, I feel like I'm getting angry about something. Well, what am I angry about, really? Is it about what's happening in front of me? Am I responding to some unresolved childhood trauma? This is really not about this moment. And is anger going to make this better or worse? And then you can make a better decision. Mm-hmm. And so if you can do that, maybe initially it takes you a few minutes, and then it'll take you a few seconds, and then it'll be like in a blink of an eye. Yeah,
I think that the conversations with yourself, it's just so important, especially when the world's so more and more getting noisy.
Yeah. And if you are so connected to yourself and have self-awareness and self-acceptance leading to self-love, there's really nothing you can't do.
Yeah. If tomorrow you have to go to a desert island, you don't know when you can go back. If you have to bring one book, what it could be?
Probably a book on how to survive. I don't think I'm not gonna last very long. You know, The Idiot's Guide on How to Survive on a Deserted Island is probably the book I would bring.
Okay.
Yeah.
You touch the reality, and you're realistic in a way, practical?
I think so.
Mm. Okay.
I'm going to bring a book of poetry about love songs, and I'll be dead the next day because I ate something I could not eat.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I would ask you a question. What does this Earl Grey Nitro say about a person? Of all the options, maybe the whole cafe is like a personality test.
I love personality tests.
Yeah.
One of my very first talk shows was like, I want to play psychology games because it says I can come up with words, you know, blah, blah, blah. That's why it's like Nitro. It's like, it's not something you know, you always try some daring options or like blah. I think it's just, in Vietnamese, it's like, Miếng Châu là đầu câu chuyện. Miếng Châu is like the thing that the old ladies would use to make the lips red.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's just the way we start talking. I feel like if we're talking about something else, then it's easier to start. And sometimes it becomes too much because like you analyze people based on their drink, but sometimes they just randomly pick that and it's just like a few seconds of their life right here, but then you try to make it big. But I think it's just the way to... I think the process before we're filming, you choosing the drink, it's saying more about you.
Yeah.
I think...
Than the drink itself?
Yeah, and the drink itself. I think coconut says something about you more than this a gray natural.
It says, my friend Jaden brought me a coconut and said, eat this. And I just follow the directions, so I'm going to eat it.
You like it. You like it.
I like it. Mm. Yeah.
I think there's some Vietnamese things about that too.
Is there?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think in America I see people holding a coconut walking on the street.
Because it's not a tropical place. We don't get coconuts to fall off the tree. Yeah.
So...
There's this exercise I do with people in my personal branding workshop. I have them look at each other and say, without knowing anything about this person, spend 1 minute looking at them, no words, and then say to them whatever you think, who they are, their story. And don't play it safe. Don't say you look like a kind person or you're really smart. And you're not doing anything. Just read how they hold themselves. What they wear, and just make a lot of wild guesses as to who you think they are. And then they stop. And I said, the instruction to the other person is, do not nod, do not smile, do not react, because you just encourage them to say something that is not true. Mm-hmm. Just try to be as stoic and still as possible. And then switch. Mm-hmm. And then I asked the room full of strangers, how accurate was it? Were people really horrible? Were they pretty good? And they're all nodding. I'm like, oh, about 80% of you said the other person was pretty on in terms of guessing about you. And it could be that they say nice things, that you just want to hear nice things, but I think there's something there. So I have a theory that's unproven. Everything that you do and I do transmit energy to the world, a signal that's silent that some people who are attentive can pick up. And what was interesting is at the end of the exercise, they said that I've been going to these workshops for a long time now. And I think for the first time, somebody's seen me in a way that I've not been seen before. So I look at you, and we're talking about tea, but I can just look at you and say, look, there's a lot of assumptions we're going to make. But I think about 80% of them are going to be right. So we just need to be more intentional about our energy, about how we carry ourselves. Like, do we smile? Do we look down? Are our eyebrows furled together? Are we just wearing like a white t-shirt and jeans? What are we doing? What does that transmit to the world? Because it does say something.
Yeah. And I kind of believe, like, even I'm a writer myself, and then it's a lot of my time is about words. And just, I think it's same like you. It's a lot of visual. But then I believe that there's some different language that we cannot be seen. It's like a, like the sound, there's some, you know, there's a part of the sound we cannot ever hear. But we find a way to expand that. And then there's a certain people that you meet in life, what kind of, you know, you get that signal.
Yeah.
So I think the journey of getting into, become an interviewer or talking to people mostly, it's me learning a new language, a new signal that maybe at one day we don't need to talk, we don't need this microphone to, you know, to record or camera. It's like it's something there, up there. So that's what I recently discovered and trying to do. But at the same time, when you get all the barriers of words, then you take assumption away, and it's like, you know, you open up for whatever happened, right?
Yeah.
Because you never know. You're a student in this world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I'm very grateful for all my guests and then doing a podcast. Still, I still cannot believe I'm here talking to you.
I can't believe I'm here talking to you.
I know. It's like, I have one last question.
Okay.
How many hats you have?
Are you talking about literally or figuratively? I'm a father. I'm a husband. No, you're talking about hats?
Yeah.
I have a lot of hats.
I'm sorry.
I probably have every time.
Okay,
maybe
name.
50?
Okay.
Yeah, and the thing is, once you start wearing hats, people send you hats, and they're giving you hats now. So I was like, oh, okay, thank you. And so my wife, she's super cool. She set up a whole shelf so that they can be on display. And so I don't wear all of them. Uh-huh. They're just there. Some of them I've never even worn. They just sit there. So if it's a cool design, mm-hmm. if it's interesting color, mm-hmm. it has a higher chance of me wearing them.
Mm.
Yeah.
And based on your mood, you choose a different hat?
Based on what I'm wearing, probably.
Okay.
Yeah. And they're structured differently. Like, I'm not a hat expert, but I'm starting to figure out certain hats and their properties and the material and how they fit and how they complement your face.
When you talk about fit, I need a shout out to my friend Ling, because just last night he mentioned this Australian designer live in Japan that have a machine that, so he makes hat just for you.
Oh, like, okay.
So it need to fit perfectly, and you will be surprised how your hat shape. It's like someone look like a peanut, someone look like a potato, and so when you're talking about hat, I'm thinking like, I think you should meet him and then see how. I mean, like, people with so many hats, maybe you find one hat that you should,
the perfect hat.
Yeah.
Okay.
Would you
be a documentary film in search of in the quest of the perfect hat?
But would you be that person, like, you're just looking for one ideal hat to wear the rest of your life or whatever?
No, I don't think so. Mm. I think different hats have different aesthetics, energy. And so depending on what I'm doing, my wife asked me, how many hats did you bring on this trip? I said, just one. She goes, oh, just one. Mm-hmm. Kind of risky, isn't it? I'm like, well, I'm going to travel light, babe. You know, if I could travel with less, I would. Yeah, and it'll be okay. So I have to think, okay, of the clothes that I brought, what hat works with what I'm wearing? And this is the hat that I'm wearing now.
It's very nice to meet you today and meet your hat too, the only hat of this trip. Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for doing this for Visitra as well. And we believe that there's a workshop that's going to conduct by you very soon as well.
Yeah.
So thank you for spending time with Have a Sip. I'm sure it's a lot of people. Well, there's a lot more things to talk to, but I feel very good. How you feel?
I feel great.
Okay.
I'm going to enjoy the rest of my trip here. And so we're going to spend a lot of time here.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. And thank you for watching. We'll see you again soon.
Cảm ơn HPV Việt Nam đã đồng hành cùng Vietcetera cho lối sống từ chối rủi ro, sống lành chủ động.